Morning, Your Honors. Chad Knight here for Venus F. Burway and Mr. Swain. And if I may, I'd like to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal.
All right. Try to watch the clock and watch it as well.
Thank you. May it please the court. The issue here before you today is whether plaintiffs met their burden of proving all of the required elements of the local controversy exception to CAFA jurisdiction. That two-thirds of the plaintiffs were citizens of Montana when the complaint was filed. That John Swing, a Montana resident, is a significant defendant. And that the principal injuries occurred in the state of Montana. I'd like to start off by addressing briefly a question of waiver. Plaintiffs contend in this case that BNSF has waived arguments regarding all elements of the exception except for principal injuries by not objecting to the magistrate's factual findings. That's not correct. In a cite to no authority in which subject matter jurisdiction was waived in this manner, and it's not. But regardless, BNSF did object. On its February 2018 objection pleading, BNSF and Mr. Swing asserted that the magistrate's recommendations as to the applicability of the exception in whole were in error, asked for de novo review of all findings supporting the magistrate's ruling, and asked the court to reject the magistrate's finding and ruling that the exception applied, not any one particular element. And the district court read it that way. The district court acknowledged the objection, actually addressed all of the elements of the exception, with the exception of principal injury, which it ultimately addressed after remand by this court last year. So all these issues are before the court, and I'd like to start with, if I may, the two-thirds requirement. The complaint itself alleges that some undisclosed number of these plaintiffs are not residents of Montana, not citizens of Montana. The complaint alleges that they are either former residents or visitors, but it doesn't say how many. And as evidence on this issue, in which they bear the burden, is an affidavit signed by plaintiff's counsel, in which he says or asserts that 146, or 76% of the 192 plaintiffs, residents of Montana as of the date of the meeting, the complaint was filed. However, when we look at the evidence that's attached to this affidavit, we see that 48 of these residents are actually post office boxes, which multiple courts in this jurisdiction are held is not sufficient to establish residency, much less citizenship. Another 14 are estates. Under Montana Administrative Rule 42.30.101, paragraph 15, a resident estate in Montana means an estate of a decedent who was a Montana resident at the time of the decedent's death. And the evidence doesn't even purport to establish those facts.
May I ask you, Mr. Knight?
Yes,
what is your position on the first three issues you raise in your brief, one of which is the citizenship with respect to Montana citizens? But you didn't object to the magistrate finding a conclusion on the issue. Why wouldn't that be a waiver or a forfeiture?
Well, Your Honor, I would refer you to our objection pleading in which we stated both at the beginning and end of the pleading that we were objecting to the magistrate's finding and conclusion that the exception applied, and then specifically said we were requesting de novo review of all factual findings that supported the magistrate's conclusion that the exception did apply.
That kind of general objection doesn't give the district court or the magistrate any clue as to what you were looking at.
Well, Your Honor, I believe it does. We're asking for a de novo review of each of the elements in our objection pleading. And the point of the list to put back to the record, the briefing that was submitted, and we raised that very issue of the insufficiency of the evidence of citizenship. I would point out that in the district court's order, the court did look at that issue. The court did reference the affidavit of counsel, and adopt magistrate's finding with regard to that. So it actually was considered in the order itself. So, Your Honor, at the end of the day, when we look at the actual evidence that's attached to the affidavit of counsel, and we move individuals for whom they don't actually have even residence addresses for, we end up with 41% of the plaintiff's class who actually even assert or provide a residence address in the state of Montana as of a year after the complaint was filed. And that's well below, obviously, the threshold that we need of two-thirds. In this court, the Ninth Circuit twice, in Mondragon, as well as in the King case that we cite, has instructed that we look at this evidence with a critical eye. In those cases, you had residence addresses that actually barely met two-thirds requirement. But in those cases, the court took a critical look at that evidence and decided that based on assumptions that people moved, that some might be military members and so forth, or students, that was insufficient to meet the plaintiff's burden. But we don't even rise to that in this case, because I mentioned...
Counsel, I know your time is running short. Can I have you address the principal injuries provision, at least, as to BNSF and defendant Swing?
Yes, Your Honor. We believe the district court erred in four ways, Your Honor. Number one is in the interpretation of the statute. You know, the U.S. Supreme Court in the Darts decision made clear, quoting the Senate report, that this CAFA provision should be read broadly with a strong preference that cases be heard in federal court. What the district court did here was improperly limit the scope of its inquiry based on its interpretation of the statute.
Well, but in analyzing principal injuries, what do we look at? How do we define the scope of the conduct? Do we look to what the plaintiffs allege and what the evidence supports? And it seems to me in this particular case that the conduct that's alleged is really the failure to sort of contain and warn about the dangers BNSF's transportation in and around the Libby area. So is that the appropriate scope of conduct that we look at to analyze principal injuries? Because you're pushing it beyond that, beyond the allegations in the complaint.
Yes, Your Honor. I do believe the court needs to look beyond just the allegations of the complaint because the statute requires that. The statute requires that the court look at both what's alleged as well as related conduct. Now, what in the Senate report, as well as cases citing to the Senate report, the court expands on that to describe that you need to be looking not at just what's alleged, but what could be alleged, not against just the NSF, but as against every defendant. So in this case, if we look at what was alleged, what could be alleged, or the related conduct of the defendant, we have to then just decide, are any one of these defendants vulnerable to suit outside of the state of Montana? In this case, there are. What we believe the district court did wrong here was to take what is BNSF's interstate transportation activity and then try to just artificially narrow those geographically. For example, the court misconstrues or misunderstands some of the evidence that's attached to the complaint, the BA report, for example. In trying to describe this as a unique, that report actually only states that with regard to BNSF's transportation activities, being near a railway where vermiculite is being filled, or a rail line, could expose someone to an inhalation. That report doesn't say that that is unique to Libby, because in fact it's not. BNSF is transporting fuel from that very small, doing so on its interstate railway. Not a Libby logger local spur as the plaintiffs have asserted, but on his interstate rail line, the same rail line that continues to carry these same cars to 180 processing sites across the country, plaintiffs have alleged. So for us to say BNSF's transportation activities, which involve carrying this vermiculite across the country, should be artificially limited to, you're only going to carve out where you carried it between point A and point B and everywhere else. I think that's an artificial limitation, and I don't think that's consistent with broad statute. Certainly the broad way that this...
It seems that we have, in terms of statutory interpretation, potentially conflicting views of it, Fifth Circuit and Third Circuit how you consider the principal injury, for example. My concern on the Fifth Circuit is really a lack of statutory analysis, but perhaps would you adopt the position of the Fifth Circuit?
I would not, Your Honor. I think that is an outlier. I think the interpretation of the other circuits and frankly, the lower courts in the Ninth Circuit is correct, that we don't look at just the way a plaintiff defines the class. We look at all the harm to anyone who may be affected by the conduct or the related conduct. The Senate report even uses that broad language of look to anyone who is affected by or. And in this case, the plaintiffs didn't or aren't asserting that they had the right to geographically limit them. But they're doing the same thing or reaching the same results by trying to artificially geographically. So just like it wouldn't be proper to say only Montana residents are suing for injury, also not proper to say we're only talking about your transportation activities within the state of Montana, but we know that you did, transportation activities extend above. Both of those are artificial limitations. Both of those are allowing a plaintiff through artful pleading to create a loophole, of which both the Senate report and the case law again. That answer your question, Ron? And so, while we're on that topic, Your Honor, and I mentioned that the court had misconstrued the EPA related to that this was some type of unique activity. And that misconstruction kind of extended to describing the activities of BNSF as being local. Describing, for example, that this was a local line or a local railroad spur, as opposed to what the activities to that federally regulated, federally mandated, for state rail operation. Another thing that the court should do that the district court didn't do was give effect to the extrinsic evidence that was presented. Now, the court hasn't adopted or ruled on whether or not this prong, it should or should not be considered. We believe, don't believe it requires an extensive wading into the facts. We presented very limited evidence. And that evidence, I think this case is a classic case of when and why that evidence is important. Because we have a situation where plaintiffs are claiming to you, court, this is a unique situation. They're not aware of any injuries outside of this jurisdiction or outside of the state. That it would be unlikely for anyone who's not exposed to these excessive levels of asbestos exposure. However, when we look at the extrinsic evidence, the very limited extrinsic evidence that we presented, we see that these same plaintiffs said the opposite and served their need. In fact, I could go through all of the extrinsic evidence we've offered, but that sum it up, since that's offered, has shown that these plaintiffs' counsel and their experts cited to reports or studies of injury they attribute to the transportation and processing and use of this product in Ohio, California, Arizona, Washington, New York, and 180 processing plants around the country.
Mr. Knight, would you like to save your remaining time?
Yes, Your Honor. I'll finish with one word. Their own expert has testified under oath in response to plaintiff's questioning, that Libby disease, not just exposure, but disease, extends everywhere. Transport. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you.
I'll enjoy the rest of my time.
All right. Next, Mr. McGarvey. Is that Glacier Park behind you there?
It is, Your Honor, yes.
I thought I recognized that. Thank you. You may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. The sole issue that is properly reserved for appeal is as stated in Burlington Northern's sole objection to the magistrate's first findings. Quote, whether citizens of other states could have been affected by the conduct alleged against BNSF. I have provided to the court a proposed framework for evaluating when and how a district court should look to extrinsic evidence And I have suggested to the court that there a test or a system, a framework for balancing the need for prompt and efficient resolution of this jurisdictional question against and the time involved in a deep dive into to evidence by the court. Counsel points out that the statute does indeed suggest a possible open door in that the word references related to. But I think related to usually is going to be clear from the face of the pleadings. What is the nature of the conduct that is pled in the pleadings? In the case that Congress cites to of you're selling a car model, obviously those car models are sold all across the country. And so the related to question can usually be resolved from the face of the pleadings. I further proposed five tests that may create a framework for a disciplined and consistent analysis of the principal injury issue. And I would like to start by pointing out that BNSF's argument utterly fails on the simplest of these tests. Unarguably, the statute does not require that all injuries be instituted, only that the principal injuries, which the congressional record demonstrates, could include a case where 90% of the injuries were in the state. In this case, decades after all of the defendant's conduct ceased, there's only been one case against BNSF. One case, one injury. And that case, it alleges a mesothelioma, which was contributed to by transportation activity of BNSF, where by far the majority of the plaintiff's exposure was take home from family members who worked at an expanding plant, and the decedent's playing on large piles of the expanding plant's tracks caused by the expanding plant's employees' unloading operations. I cite you to footnote 12 of my brief for the citation for that. Similarly, there's no indication of a single injury out of the state of Montana from Maryland Casualty's conduct, which ended in 73, or from Bob Montana's operations, which ended in 1986. It's now several decades later. Even with latency of asbestos considered, we would have seen lots of out-of-state injuries by now if there were any, if there were to be any. But one injury has been identified by BNSF, and that injury is only marginally contributed to by BNSF. This is compared to thousands of Montana injuries arising right in the community of Libby. The easy question is, where did the principal injuries occur? And the answer is in Montana. The second key point is that even in that one
case— So just to make sure that I understand your argument correctly, counsel, I think that the railway's argument on principal injuries really kind of focus on the nature of their conduct, and given the transportation of it across the country, one would reasonably think that there might be similar torts committed that occurred in other states as well, if you focus on the nature of what it was that they did in this case. But I take your argument to be that even if we focus on the nature of the conduct, there still have to be some indication in the record that, in fact, there were injuries of a similar nature occurring elsewhere. So had that been the record, it would have made a difference in this case?
Absolutely, Your Honor. The focus should be both on the conduct and on the injury. And what is it about the conduct that would expect to cause injury in the state or out of the state? And so, because BNSF is a railroad and it does transportation around the country, the leap that is trying to be suggested is that there was the same kind of contamination conduct that caused the same kind of extraordinary exposure levels that would cause these kinds of injuries. And it's simply not the case. Our case is not about transportation. It's about dumping through chutes at the loading facility with the dust piling on the cars, and those cars going down a local railroad thing where the dust is blowing off and they go into the local rail yard and it accumulates at this incredible level. And then the trains run through that level and the dust gets out at a level 140 times OSHA standards. Nothing like that happened anywhere else in the U.S. And if it had, of course, there would be injuries around the U.S.
But was there testimony about that, that really that this kind of concentrated arrival, deposit, and then dust up was unique to the Libby situation?
It's unique to Libby, Your Honor. It's the only place where this anything remotely like this happened, and BNSF hasn't shown anywhere else. The closest it comes is this one case where there was another expanding facility, and they had big piles at that expanding facility, and you had a decedent who worked and their parent worked at the expanding facility. Of course, there's a situation. Nowhere in the U.S. were there fiber levels anywhere near the extraordinary exposures that came from the unique contamination of Montana. And that's the question, is was there conduct that caused injury or could have caused injury? No, there simply is not. The other thing I'd point out, Your Honor, is that the conduct alleged in that Miller case is, and I quote from the pleadings, in that case, ordinary transportation activity, as distinguished from loading cars, freshly loaded cars running down the Libby spur track, the Libby logger spur track, accumulations 4 to 6 feet deep. This is the conduct alleged in this complaint that creates a unique local controversy over a unique contamination and a unique pathway for injury. Of course, there were other locations around the nation where other non-defendant entities, other expanding plants used vermiculite and may have created dangerous conditions. None of those expanding plants are defendants in this case. And counsel argued that expert testified that wherever this stuff is transported, it causes disease. And if you look at the testimony, and it's in BNSF's excerpts of record 486, you can see that what the expert actually said is the Libby disease exists wherever Libby vermiculite was shipped to and used or processed further. You have to actually encounter this dust. Transportation is not the conduct that causes injury. It is the creation of injurious asbestos fiber exposures. I want to make the point that NSF's attempt to raise these other arguments is not proper, and it's a due process issue. And the reason it's a due process issue is when the magistrate makes findings and makes conclusions that are fact-based, there is a de novo hearing before the district court judge. And that is the plaintiff's opportunity to respond to the objections that the defendant makes to the magistrate's findings. There was only one basis. Sure, the district court went on to address all the elements as it appropriately should in adopting it, but there was only one objection. No opportunity, therefore, for the plaintiffs to supplement the record. This ridiculous suggestion that these people that were injured in Libby, maybe more than one third of them moved out of Montana. Well, of course we could meet that if we were given the opportunity. We were denied that opportunity. There is one issue that is before this court. The final point, Your Honor, judges, is that there is an Article III jurisdictional problem here. This case was never intended to be a group action. The district court found that it was pled as such, but the pleading itself says that it is filed for the purposes of preserving the statute of limitations. And the reason for that is that we had a whole bunch of plaintiffs that could not pursue their cases because of an injunction in the bankruptcy court of the W.R. Grace and Company. So when that bankruptcy court injunction expired, the statute of limitations started to tick, and we filed this group action. And we did so recognizing that every case that we filed up to then would get split out according to cases that are appropriately tried together on common facts. But most importantly, it was filed upon recognition that Montana has not resolved the question of how do you preserve your statute of limitations once you've been diagnosed for a case in which your injuries have not yet occurred. And of course, around the country, there are deferred dockets that address this unique situation for asbestos claims. And there is now a deferred docket system in the asbestos court in Montana. But the point that I'm trying to make is that when BNSF had jumped in and before it was even served, removed this under CAFA jurisdiction, that raised these CAFA questions, but it doesn't address the question of Article III jurisdiction. Is there a case in controversy for these plaintiffs who do not have ripe cases? They never had ripe cases. Their cases will only become ripe when their disease matures into impairment. So that has been resolved by the effect of the asbestos, Montana asbestos claim court determination that for these unimpaired claimants, their claims are not ripe for adjudication. And that same concern should be before this court. Do we have a controversy with 100 or more plaintiffs that would best support with jurisdiction given this ripeness issue? This is a crazy case to be addressing CAFA questions, and it rose out of my failure to recognize that I could have split this into two place marker cases, each with less than 100. I failed to recognize there was a CAFA issue. Nonetheless, this is not a case that addresses the interests of Congress that is concerned about class action jurisdiction. The nature of the injury here, it defines where the principal injuries occur. And the nature of the injury arises specifically from unique conduct that uniquely contaminated and uniquely resulted in extraordinary levels of exposure. Sure, one fiber can theoretically cause an epithelioma. Theoretically. This is not a one fiber case. This is extraordinary contamination that is unique to Libby, has injured thousands of people, and only one other person has even suggested that railroad was involved in a vermiculite related disease. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good
night.
Your Honor, first I want to address the statute itself. This is not a question of whether there are more or a lot of or most of the claims within the state of Montana. This court has previously held that the question is whether or not this is a local controversy where the fund is localized to a single jurisdiction or state to the exclusion. So we're not talking about, this court shouldn't delve into trying to figure out a one state versus another. That would be an issue that would be difficult to do on the record. The thing that I think plaintiff's counsel gets backwards is who has the burden here. It is not BNSF and Mr. Swain's burden to prove that BNSF has been sued or is vulnerable to suits in other states. We have produced evidence showing that it's, as occurred out there, therefore, we're certainly as plausible as the different cases I've shown to understand that BNSF is vulnerable to suits outside of Maine. It was the plaintiff's burden to prove otherwise. Prove that BNSF is not adjudicated. We don't believe they've done that here. To artificially limit and misdescribe BNSF's transportation activities as a local Libby Logger stir, out of the evidence, it's not in the complaint, it's not proven factually when we're talking about what BNSF's activities are. And when you have a plaintiff whose own experts say any exposure to asbestos fibers medically causative of injury, whether or not it's 140 times or 10 times or 5 times the safe limit is irrelevant.
Thank you.
I'm out of time unless you want me to keep talking.
No, I don't. I was just kind of waiting for you to have that wrap-up sentence. So I think I heard it. So thank you.
All right. Thank you for your time.
The case just argued of Arstead versus BNSF Railway Company is submitted. Thank both counsel for your argument. And we now will hear argument in Garcia versus SEIU.